pleasure to be here and meet you all. And thanks for the nice introduction as well. So what I'm actually really interested in is how we actually perceive the world around us, and in particular social interaction. And even more in particular, what I'm really interested in is trying to understand what are the behavior of these cells that compose our body and our mind, how they basically perceive the world, and how the information that each cell is acquiring is then put together to create the self
that we are, and how this also influences our behavior and the choice that we make. So as Jan was pointing out, I'm not directly studying improvisation or joint improvisation, joint actions, but a bit social interactions. And I think these two are very much related anyway. I also like to really, I'm here with you, so I want to tell you a little bit of me. So this is my family. This is my husband, Chris, and some of you met him yesterday. This is one of my daughters. This is Julia, the oldest one. Now she's 5. And this is my dad. So I just take this as an example of our everyday life and a social interaction. I think that each of you can easily understand that they're having fun, right? And in this interaction, there are many components that play together. One is, okay, we see actions going on. My father is approaching Julia and grasping her hand. And we have seen yesterday, at least Chris, I hope, he told you a little bit how we process the actions of other people. And now I would like you to make an exercise. So we always take his perspective for the duration of my talk. So we are Chris, right? And so Chris is witnessing the interaction between my dad and Julia. And as Chris probably mentioned yesterday, the action, if we just take the action part of this scene, is basically activating a region of Christian's brain, basically, that would also be active when Chris himself acts. Okay, you see a grasping, and the areas that would make Chris grasp would become activated again. Is that clear? Okay, but this scene is not just made out of actions. What can we see? We see here, for instance, sorry?
Smiles.
Smiles, that's going to be next. And touch. Yeah, people like my dad is grasping Julia's hands, and Julia is receiving a touch. So there is a sensation that goes on. And how do we study, or how do we perceive the sensations of other people? So what I'm going to show you basically throughout my talk is just a series of paradigms that we keep using to start investigating the main topic I'm interested in. Obviously, I don't have an answer for you, and I will probably not have one until in my life, so, but just how we approach these problems. So one of the very first experiments that we ran to understand how we process the touch of other people was really like asking participants to come into the scanner, and I use, again, functional magnetic resonance imaging to basically picture what happens in your brain. And here we showed our participants videos at that time in which either a rod, a sticking rod, was touching the leg of an actor, and these are Chris's leg, by the way, or we showed videos of the rod making the same movement but without any touch involved. And what we can do then, we can basically picture what areas in the brain are specifically activated by seeing the touch compared to the non-touch. So the movement component is basically the same, but the main difference between these two sets of stimuli is the presence or absence of touch. And then again, in our paradigms, we always make you to experience what you observe. So we actually touch the leg of the participants afterwards to map what brain regions are activated by you being touched. And this is what you see. I mean, I don't mind now that you look at the location per se. I mean, it's the idea that I want to really convey. So here are the areas that are active when you feel the touch, and here are the areas that are active when you observe the touch. And if you now compare them, you see that there is an overlap between the two. So again, there was another evidence on top of all the ones that have been collected for the actions that when you observe somebody else, like being touched, for instance, you activate regions of the brain that are also active when you feel the touch yourself. So it's very similar to what happens for the actions as well. And you see, I just want to make it clear, you also have many other regions. So it's not the whole story I'm going to tell you, but that is one of the things that is also happening. And as you also pointed out, here we have emotions going on. And it's a pleasant emotion in this case. And again, we wanted to study what happens when we observe somebody else's emotion. And one of the very first experiments, we used disgust as an emotion. Some people argue whether disgust is a true emotion or not, and I will show you experiments with more true emotions. But it is one easy to induce, because the problem with emotions is that they are the time resolution is not very clear, so it's very hard to really set a specific time in which you have to be happy. And with disgust, we have an anesthesia mask on your face, and then we would just puff in a bit of disgusting odorant, and then you can really time when the odorant wants in or not. And the videos, I can show you the videos, but I can also improvise the videos. I think it's faster. So we had neutral condition, so we would have a glass, and then the actor would go drinking from the glass. And then we have a disgusted kind of condition in which the actor would go taking the glass, go like this. So if I ask you from which glass you would like to drink, I guess you would choose the first, unless you're really super adventurous. And then again, we made the participants to feel the disgust itself, because we wanted to map the regions of the brain again that they were also involved in your own perception of disgust. So we basically presented smells like the rotten eggs. Very disgusting. We had to take one of the participants out because it was almost throwing out. And I was a participant myself at that time, so I can guarantee you that they did a good job. So here what you see in red, again, are the areas of the brain that are active when you feel disgusted yourself. And in blue here, you see the areas of the brain that are active when you observe somebody else being disgusted. And if you overlap, so what you see in white is, again, the overlap between the two, you see, again, that when you observe somebody else as being disgusted, you activate your own, basically, the areas that makes you feel disgust. And this is...
it looks to be like a bit of a trend, that we really use, in a way, our own experience of what it is like to spontaneously interpret what happens to the other people. This area of the brain that I showed you being involved in the disgust, for instance, if it's lesioned, you lose the ability to recognize disgust in others. Okay, and you don't lose the ability to recognize other emotions.
Or should you only lose the ability to recognize disgust? And if you stimulate in that region as well, people would start to contract, like vomiting. And there was also a patient that you could really offer like a piece of cake completely rotten and he would just take it and eat it. So they really lose the sense of disgust. Yes?
Can I just clarify? So it's not just perception,
it's both. This is the experience. So actually it's both. So you had cases of deficit in perception and deficit also in the experience. So this region seems to really do both. Because what's different between the emotion and the sensations case compared to the actions is that we don't really have a neuronal recorded for which we can really guarantee that the response, it really overlaps in a cell, for instance. Here we use fMRI, so you can only speak of areas, so you don't really know exactly what this overlap means. But the main idea is that you really use your own substrate, basically, to interpret the other people. And this is true for disgust. I promised you that I would go in other emotions too. So it's also true for pain. So if you observe people being in a painful situation, you activate your own experience of pain, areas that are involved in your own experience of pain. It's also true for pleasure. So for all the emotion that you witness, you sort of reactivate your own representation of what you just saw. And this works also while reading about emotions. Like when you turn around to look who is leaning on your shoulder, you are peering into the unsightly face of a homeless guy. The guy leans forward and discharges the complete content of his inflamed stomach on you. You are covered with decaying vomit that was formed by rotten meat picked out of the garbage cans across the street. You can feel your stomach contract. Then you feel a hard, fleshy piece of his vomit in the corner of your mouth. So even when you read these stories, your insula... Yeah. You're welcome. Just to start the day, right? I could have chosen a nice piece of cake. So a quick summary of the concept that I want you to take home so far is that very often the substrates involved in the perception of self often overlap with those involved in the perception of others. And we are also confronted with interacting circuits. So before I presented the scene and I was speaking in boxes like action, sensation, and emotion, but the scene you've witnessed before, it's not just a box of action, sensation, and emotion, but it's all things together. So all these circuits actually interact with each other and they are active at the same time based on the circumstances. And in the other observation we had is that the strength of these reactivations, so the fact that you reactivate your own experience when you witness others, is often positively correlated with empathic traits. So how do we measure empathic traits? So far, we mainly use questionnaires, very simple things. It's arguable whether it's the right way, but it's one of the ways. And I give you an example. We use, for instance, the Interpersonal Reactivity Index developed by Davies. And now I'm going to ask you to basically give a value from 0 to 4 to this sentence, where 0 means this sentence doesn't describe me well at all, and 4 describes me very well. So when I'm upset at someone, I usually try to put myself in his shoes for a while. Who would rate 3 to 4? Okay. Who? 1? 0? Yeah, I need that. I mean, we are. Okay, keep that in mind. And then I would give you another set of questions like this, very similar. And then here, what I show you, this is the group analysis of when we, of basically the shared circuits for action, so areas that are active both when we act and when we observe somebody else. This is a group result. And then here, what I'm plotting is basically all the responses of my participants to the questionnaire. So you see that there is quite some variability in the rating. Some were really high and some very low. So I took the 6 that told me, yes, that sentence was depicting me like around 3 to 4. And then I plotted the circuits again. And you see how much they spontaneously activate while observing the other's actions. And then I plotted basically the activity to the 6 that gave me the lowest value. And you see that their activity is much lower. It's spontaneously much lower. I will go back to this spontaneously later. So there seems to be a correlation between, for instance, how much you activate spontaneously this activity and how much you take the perspective of other people. Do we always share? I've just shown you that there is variability between participants of how spontaneously they tend to activate the circuits. But it's not just differences between individuals. It could also be that there are cases in which we ourselves react differently, right? We don't need to be always super sharing. There might be a moment where we need to stay with ourselves and therefore be less open to the others. So, and here I'm going to show you a couple of experiments that try to basically investigate these issues. And this is from the work of Tanya Singer, another big neuroscientist in the field. And she made a manipulation of tasks. So normally she has a participant in the scanner, and this participant witnessed somebody else getting an electroshock on the hand. Just a small electrical shock. Before doing the experiment, though, she made the participant to play with two other players, one that was instructed to play fairly and one that was instructed to play unfairly. Okay, and then she basically had a group of female participants. She put them in the scanner after playing with these two other guys, and she made them witness basically the two guys getting the electroshock. And what she found is that basically the activity while witnessing the pain of the others is reduced for the unfair player compared to when they see the fair player getting the electroshock. And then she had a group of male participants, and you see that this difference is even stronger. Okay, so there are differences in many ways within ourselves and between individuals. And it's also easy to create these differences. Like if I would now give you a red t-shirt and for you a yellow t-shirt, so making two groups, and I would be part of the yellow group, and now I would do the same experiment where I see either a yellow member after we have done something together, obviously, a yellow member getting the electroshock or a red member getting the electroshock, again, I would see a reduction in how much I activate my empathy or my responses to the pain of the other for the team that was not mine. So these are all artificial kind of situations, but they do manipulate our perception of the other people. And responsibility is another, basically, is also modeling, how we perceive the other people, how much we activate this region. And we had an experiment in which, for instance, I put you in the scanner, and then Sway, which is another experimenter, but you don't know, you think she's another participant, she's going in another room and she will get again a small electroshock. And then you play together this task. So you need to press to respond as quickly as possible to the middle letters. And this stays on the screen for a very short time. And basically, this is the correct answer. And if you both, you and her, have the correct answer, I said it was went quickly, then she would get a neutral electroshock. But if either one of you makes the wrong response, then she would get a painful electroshock. And you that are in the scanner, you will see her getting like this. You think you see her in real time. You see her basically getting the electroshock. So in this way, we could modulate the amount of responsibility that you had in causing the pain of Sway. For both playing correct, there is no pain, and the stimulation is innocuous. If you are incorrect, but Sway is correct, then you have the full responsibility in causing the pain to her. And if the participant is incorrect and Sway is also incorrect, then the responsibility is shared. And if you're correct and she's incorrect, then there is no responsibility from your side. It's all her own responsibility. And what we saw is that, again, the activity that you normally have when you see her in pain is reduced when you share the responsibility. Okay, so you are less perceptive, basically, to the other when you're not fully responsible for the causing the pain. So again, we have an easy manipulation of how we perceive the other person. And another model that we use to study empathy, and this is what we like, despite it's an animal model, is the fact that nowadays you have very nice technique to actually study the cell behavior. And not only the cell behavior nowadays. Nowadays you can really study the whole circuit's behavior. So finally, we could have some answer probably to our questions. And rats are quite social animal. And they do seem to manifest at least what we call emotional contagion. So they're really affected by the state of the other. So again, the task is very simple. We have the demo, like the Sway before she got a small electroshock. They also gets a small electroshock. It's just unpleasant. It's nothing hurtful. And the observer here, if the observer has experienced an electroshock in the past, will then freeze. Just listen now and just freeze when the demonstrator gets the electroshock. And if the observer never had an electroshock before, it would just behave normally. And that's what you see in the graph here. So this is the experienced observer. And you see that when the demo gets the electroshock, the amount of freeze is increased. And when the observer is inexperienced, the amount of freezing is not even present, basically. But the interesting part of the story is that the demo itself changes its behavior based on the response of the observer. So if the demonstrator is paired with the experienced observer, it will freeze more in self than if it is paired with an observer that never experienced an electroshock before. So there is a circle. We really are affected by the other, and we affect the other in a similar way. Here, let's take a walk into the desert. I love deserts because I live in the Netherlands, so I like sun. And look at these pictures. I was a bit too fast, but what I see is that here we increase a little bit the amount of pain that we perceive. And so you increase your activity, your response to this person. And now, if this person were to be your child, what would you do? Would you just observe?
Stop.
Yeah, you would try to stop. So what I want to say now, or to convey, is that one of the recent ideas that we had, or we are playing with, is this the fact that maybe the strength of this activity also can function as a motivator. And you have another case, for instance, when you feel the pain yourself, you tend to remove the cause of pain. So you're really motivated to remove the source of your pain because you don't want to stay in pain. So when you see somebody like this little girl being sad because she has to stay in bed because of her caste, basically, your reaction would be to go and make her laugh or try to make her happier. And so we try to study these more in depth, basically by recruiting a psychopath. We know that psychopaths commit crimes, and they seem to be charming while at the same time very able to hurt other people, so they seem not to care. So we thought, okay, maybe they show reduced activity to the others. So we made them witness emotional actions. So we have interactions of hands. First is, pain. So you basically have a hand eating another one. You should see. And then we have exclusion. So a social exclusion, one hand is approaching and the one is pushing the other one away. Then we have neutral, and then we have pleasant. And then we basically made them experience the same thing. So we hit them, we exclude them, we shake their hand, and we caress them. And what we found at first is that if you compare the group of controls with the psychopaths, you see that what you see here is what the control has more in activity than the psychopath. So basically, the control activated their somatosensory and their emotional areas and their action area more than the psychopath. And from there, we concluded, oh, yes, so the psychopath have a reduced activity, so that's why they don't care. But then we thought, are they really unable to empathize, or they are really good at controlling when they want to empathize? Because they can be quite charming, too. So we asked them to put themselves in the shoes of the receiver hand, really, to put effort and say, okay, now try to think how the other one feels and how it is. And in that case, basically, all the differences within the circuits that are involved in your perception of these stimuli basically went away. So the psychopath, when you ask them to, they are able to put themselves in the shoes of others, but they would not do so spontaneously. And again, that's this concept that now we are playing around with. It's this difference between the ability and the propensity to feel with the other. Another experiment that shows a bit the influence of others in the behavior, basically. Now we perceive the others into the behavior, in particular prosocial behavior, is this one. So we had a learning phase in this experiment where you came in and you would learn a rhythm on a bongo. And then the experimenter would also rate how easily it was for you to learn this sequence. And then you would play this bongo, this is the practice phase, this rhythm, with an experimenter that would play synchronously with you and an experimenter that would play asynchronously with you. And then again, we have a playing phase in the scanner, so we could record the brain activity. And we had an helping phase, like a prosocial task at the end. So either the synchronous or the asynchronous experimenter were dropping pencils on the floor, and we were counting basically how many pencils the participants would collect to help basically the experiment. So the experimenter came with a table, you know, it was. And what we first observed is that the number of pencils that people collected was higher for the player that plays synchronously compared to the asynchronously one. And also that the easiness that you had in learning the rhythm was also predicting the number of pencils. This is important. And the caudate nucleus, which is involved in the reward processing and also in associating basically a stimulus with its consequences, was indeed correlated both with the number of pencils corrected and with the easy to which you learn the rhythm, but was not correlated with performance itself, how well you play the rhythm. So the idea here, and I want to really come back to what Lior pointed out yesterday, is that to be able to be open to the others, like collecting the pens, you need somehow to be in a comfort zone, the easiness. So these people were not focused on playing the rhythm so much because it was easy for them. And for the people for which it was difficult to learn, then they were so much concentrated on the task that their attention could not go and be open to the other. So these moments of comfort, they have something quite positive, I think, to it, because they really allow you to look around and not just stay inward all the time. Then I don't know what happens if you stay in the comfort zone. That's another idea. So I skip this, and I quickly go to my last slide. So here again, we are at our scene. So we activate basically our own experience of actions and emotion and sensations. And therefore, we create an inner representation of what happens to the others. And what I call, and I like to call, projection of self. And now, quickly, I want to split you into groups. You please close your eyes. And I tell you when to open. And you look at me. Okay, look. Now you can open your eyes, and some of you can tell me what I did. Yeah, please. Okay, can somebody tell me how I did it? Can you look what they did? Is that correct? Because I did it with my mouth and with a hand. And again, that illustrates nicely and very simply the fact that the first spontaneous reaction, because we don't always have all the information available there. So the first spontaneous reaction that we have is really using what we know and what we would do in that circumstances to interpret what the other did. So it's really a bias, first bias interpretation. I had a book. Thanks. And then obviously this is, you see, it's going to be a biased interpretation. So Chris is going to put himself in my dad's shoes and in Julia's shoes, but you can clearly see the differences there. And so with just this spontaneous activity, it's not going to be an accurate perception. So we need other mechanisms to actually cooperate and interact with that to have a better and more, hopefully, more realistic. Here we can also discuss in perception and then a proper reaction to the other. I hope I was clear enough and you enjoyed the talk. Thank you for your attention. And this is our group.
Thanks, Valeria, so much. We open up questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Patrick.
The tradition we did yesterday would be nice to hear many people, including people who haven't spoken up.
I have spoken before. Well, I just had, it was great, really interesting. I have a couple of clarification questions. When you were talking about the different emotional responses, a naive look at your slide, it looked like it was the same area for the different responses, or is that right or wrong?
Yes, it is. So it's very
delicate. So pain and happiness.
It's super interesting because we are dealing with this problem that we cannot understand or differentiate. We don't have the ability to basically see whether the activity of the insula in particular is actually specific for emotions or not. Or what is coding is maybe arousal or something that is common through the emotions. Because often what you see is that there is a huge overlap between the different emotions in the activity that you look in the brain. So it could either be that within the cluster you have single cells responding to different emotions, but then at the cluster level they would mix, so you don't see this specificity.
So you just don't have the resolution, I guess.
We don't have the resolution, and we are working with epileptic people now. So we hope to get... And with the rodent, we actually recorded already a few cells. And in the rodent, we see again the overlap, but we only have one emotion now, so we're going to...
Okay. Yeah. And the other one was the experiment. Can you go back in your slides to the one with the... Sorry, I'll say when.
you don't see this. Okay.
It's towards the end, but so that, yes, that one.
The psychopath.
Oh no, before the psychopath, the one before. The
one below.
Below.
Next one.
Yeah.
The what?
So was it an interaction? So you're saying that if people, the drumming one.
The drumming one. Okay. Yes. Okay.
22, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's fine. So with that, I was confused, but you have got a number of pencils against ease of imitation.
Exactly. I need do you have two lines? Because one is against the number of pencils collected for the sync, for the experiment that was playing synchronously, and you have the one that is collected for the experiment that was asynchronously. I mean, this is a not super strong effect, but we had a trend for a correlation between the ease of rhythm of imitation and number of pencils only in the case in which the person dropping the pencil was the one that played synchronously. And there is nothing, and even the opposite, almost the opposite direction for the experiment that they play asynchronously. I mean, this was an early study, so we also didn't have a lot of participants, so that's, we lack a bit of power there. But it's quite clear, I think, anyway, that you have the opposite.
Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick.
Can you say also your name, please?
My name is Cristobal.
Hi.
And so if I understand well, in your last, you say that it's not necessary, it's not correlated to have an easy way to be empathic and to be accurate, no?
Yeah.
So my question is, what are these functions to be, in order to be more accurate? Because if, like you say, maybe you can have an easy way to being empathic, but maybe this is a big bias in order to know what is happening the other side. So, like, maybe you are projecting yourself too much in the other. So what are these mechanisms? Are regulations or...?
So you can use, like, there are, like, thoughts as well, so you can really train yourself, and the moment you feel what your first reaction, you could really... consciously say, okay, let me see, let me think. What do I know about the other person? How do I think she actually feels based on what you know? You can ask, you can compare. I mean, the ways that so far we think are more commonly used are more cognitive kind of ways, because this seems to be quite of a spontaneous reaction, so you get it. And then also there are regular, like, you can regulate them, and you can regulate it through cognitive processes or exercising. I mean, I don't know, I'm open to ideas, because we are still looking for that.
And if suppose we know which one of these cognitive actions you do in order to regulate this, and there is like some brain regions that you study to involve in this regulation, maybe frontal, you know, brain activity specifically.
Yeah,
normally
areas like the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex are important for regulating. Uh-huh. And now what we want to do is try to use technique like the transcranial direct current stimulation, so you induce current to manipulate or to alternate, to alter a little bit the activity, disturb the activity in that area to see how that influences in the behavior.
Uh-huh.
So we are playing around with that.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's very hard. I think that the concept that one area does something is a bit shaky nowadays.
It's only a naive question, but maybe...
No, but I mean, it's not at all a naive question. It's just that we come from a tradition of looking for an area with a specific function, and we are now turning to the idea of a system and what comes out of the system, and maybe the togetherness, or like more areas playing together in certain circumstances is what gives you the unique behavior and not an area in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, frontal areas are normally involved in regulation, yeah.
I want to ask some kind of, maybe it's a silly question, but it's a big question,
mm-hmm.
So feel free to answer it if you want, but we are talking a lot of this word information, but what do you put in it? What's information, or just for you?
Yeah, that's a super good question. The answer is I don't know. So it depends what you're looking at. If you're looking at the visual cortex, the information that goes into the visual cortex are stripes, dots, shades, very simple type of information. The information that comes already to more frontal areas is much more complex. And even in the cells like that we recorded for the actions, for instance, one cell responds to a sequence of actions that is coherent and not to a sequence of action that is incoherent. So the response is already, the information that comes there is multi-dimensional in a way. So it's already more complex. So it's hard to define, and we still don't know yet, at every stage, what is the information that is coded. That is what we are trying to understand, actually. I don't know if it answers your question.
I don't know. It was maybe my question was like a little before this, like... how do you know something is an information or not? Where do you begin it? Where do you start it and where do you stop it? What's the limit? Is there an information before you say this is an information, etc., etc.?
So there are a lot of unconscious processes directing your attention towards a scene, and this is defining also how much information you actively process. There is much more information that comes in, but you're not consciously and you're not necessarily processing everything at every stage. And these attentional processes are quite spontaneous, or they are biased on your previous knowledge and experience. So you're not always totally free, or when you first approach a group, unless you really consciously decide to put your attention to a specific aspect, then the brain sort of, or your experience sort of, decides for you what's relevant. And then you can turn around and you can act. But it's not a concept that is defined very well. So, I mean, I just give you some of the ideas that we use.
We have a few questions from you. Let's have some questions in this region.
Yeah, bye.
I can start. Thanks for enlightening us. So with the question of overlap, I was wondering whether experiments in which you combine two emotions, right, either in terms of additive effect or synergistic effect or conflict effect, because, you know, you want to both kiss someone and hit one at the same time, right, and how this would be mapped. I think that would give you a bit of a resolution and maybe activate other sort of conflict resolution centers in the brain. I don't know.
It does and it doesn't, unfortunately. I mean, this manipulation, you see that you vary the amount and the strength of activity. You will see that you have error signal maybe in the difficult case coming in. So you have maybe one area more active in that condition than the other. But... it doesn't really give us the resolution that we would hope for still. I mean, it's a very nice manipulation that has been used, and it is used, but still a bit far from what we would hope.
Can you hold this question for 1 second?
Sorry. I was just wondering, the pro-social and then those social brand, it seems like we have an implicit assumption that this is what caused what happened, but is it possible those people who are more pro-social has those traits tended to da-da-da and therefore da-da? Just the directional.
The direction is obviously not clear, but here we didn't choose the people to be pro-social or not. Right? If you would split the group in pro-social people and less pro-social, so I believe that's a combination of the two. So you have people that have more a pro-social tendency and people that have less. But here they are not split. We didn't choose the people to be pro-social. So it's randomly that they were assigned to the synchronous or asynchronous experimenter. So I think that the fact that you see here is really given by the fact that drumming together in a synchronous way it increased, if you had any propensity to do so.
First of all, thank you for a good integration of research in this field. My question is about ecology of the stimuli.
Yeah.
So the part of the study you presented use real social interaction, so it's very ecological studies, and others use it pictures, videos, maybe more ecological. So how do you see? I think this difference may create the difference in the results.
Yeah, there are.
So my question mainly on pain stimuli.
Yeah. Yeah, especially, and I can tell you pain and fear, especially like the amygdala, for instance, for ages was thought to be the fear center, and people saw that it was responding to fearful pictures. The moment you use movies and you show different emotions, the amygdala answers equally, right? So the type of stimuli that you use is very important, and also with the pain, the fact, for instance, we have a lot of manipulation in which we let the person meet the people before and interact, and this activates much more your pain areas that if you don't do that. So we have to be careful what we can conclude and generalize from these studies, because even when you try to go for the naturalistic setting, you're still limited to the lab environment. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you do find like same areas in different experiments running with kind of similar but different tasks. You still find some consistency across studies and different group, which kind of ensures that maybe there is something there, but we have really to take it carefully. So your pain experience even would change if I make you experience or not before what it feels to receive an electrical discharge. You will react differently.
Do you think the difference only in the it's more strong in more ecological studies and less in, or it's a quality difference?
Could be both. I don't think it's just a matter of strength. It's really like that the circumstances are different. So why would you use even the same set of areas for different circumstances? There is not, to me, there is not necessarily a sense. I mean, if you see your brain like a population, like it's a lot of cells together, a lot of people together, why would we always use the same people to do something? It's not going to work. I mean,
We really need to move on to Attila's comment.
Thanks a lot. I'm curious about acts of cruelty that are committed by people who are not clinically diagnosed as psychopaths, because psychopaths, you gave us at least a clue about how it works. But would you say that they have this similar spontaneous response of empathy, but they depress it? Or is there another mechanism? I just heard about a study of people playing poker and are being offered with a lie detector. And they're being offered a higher gain if they cheat, so the lie detector detects it, but it fails to detect it when they're told that when they cheat, the money goes to charity. So it just occurred to me that maybe there's a depression mechanism, but maybe there's also another process somewhere else that justifies the lack of empathy and a priori.
Sure, that's what I call regulation as well. Okay. I mean, and also circumstances. I mean, we are constantly under that regulation. Because even without going too extreme, it's not convenient to always empathize all the time, also for your well-being, right? So we are constantly under that regulation. But to go back to the beginning of your question, yes, there are differences between the psychopath and the people that just committed once. These people have impulsivity. They react to that moment in an extreme way. They cannot control themselves in that circumstances, but they are not premeditative. The psychopath seems to really have a more premeditative and more like a regulatory constant ability to regulate.
I can add for that. Because I work with borderline personality disorder. Exactly. My PhD is on borderline personality disorder. And actually, I study their tendencies and their family empathize tendencies. And so they kind of have the opposite picture of psychopath, because they really they feel what you feel, but they're not able to understand, to put themselves in your shoes. It's vice versa to psychopath, which they can understand what you feel, but they don't feel the same way. Was like my first idea. And there's another thing I just want to do it because I have a lot of things to say because I really work on the same field, sort of. But just to pay attention that pain, perceiving of pain, really, is correlated with your mental state. Like depressed people, they it changes their pain perceive. So yeah. Just that.
Thanks, Hila. Thanks for all the wonderful comments. Valeria is still here, so we can continue. In the sake of time, we have to continue, so I want to present Asaf to present our next speaker.